Ladies and gentlemen, this is Secret Skin. What up, my Scandinavians? Skinny Dippers. Principal Skinners. I'm your host, Michael Eagle. Also known as Open Mike Eagle. Also known as Jeffrey. I want to say a quick thank you to everyone that sent in guest suggestions last week. I appreciated those. Among them, there were some I hadn't thought of, some I will probably never get, and just a few that I just plain don't want. Sorry, I mean, like, what am I supposed to say to kinda damn Lisa Rice?
Excuse me, Ms. Rice, what were your parents smoking?
Send all suggestions, questions, and comments and show-related concerns to omebooking@gmail.com. On this week's show, we have the legendary DJ, the one and only Gas Lamp Killer. We have a nice, long, juicy, robust conversation among his career peaks and valleys and most of his life story. Be prepared to find out why he got fired a bunch of times. He happens to be one of the resident DJs at the Low End Theory, and I'm playing there this Wednesday. If you're an LA resident or someone who doesn't live in LA, and you're looking for an excuse to spend a bunch of money traveling here, come visit Wednesday. And immediately following this interview, stay tuned for a special announcement regarding musics. Musics. This is your secret radio hour, folks. Thanks for tuning in. There's a secret radio hour. There's a secret radio hour. There's a secret radio hour. It's interesting, you know, when we were setting up, you were saying you don't usually sit and talk like this. Have you had like bad experiences with speaking your mind?
I'm just shy.
Are you?
Once I hear it.
Okay.
I'm not shy with a friend in the room.
Yeah.
But then I'll hear it later and feel like I said too much, you know? That happens to me a lot.
Is there something you feel like you should be protecting?
Well, I just have been on my own in this industry for so long, and I walk a fine line between, you know, a crazy-ass performer who maybe you'd think lives their lives in a out-of-control, right, wild manner.
Right.
But actually, I'm not like that when I get off stage. I'm very thoughtful and present and aware, and try to only share things that either A, are positive, right, or B, if they're critiquing society in any way, I need to be extremely focused and clear on what I'm trying to say. And sometimes feelings can muck up words, and the feelings don't allow you to translate the words, and your passion doesn't allow you to translate it into words correctly, and you end up feeling like, whoa, I didn't mean it that way. It could, right, be construed this way, you know, even in an interview.
Sure.
You know, not just in type.
No, I feel the same way. A lot of times people ask me questions, especially if they're good questions, and my answer might be a thought just like bigger than the words that I have at my command in that,
exactly,
moment. So a lot of times I go back like, you know, I didn't say it exactly right.
Yeah, I mean, I've done a couple that I'm like, damn, there's some dope tidbits to sample, but would I share this with my fans? So the curator shares it with theirs, and then I don't share it with mine because I feel timid about some of the things that I've said. That's a very common thing with me, unfortunately.
What do you think is the danger in getting like kind of too close to your fans or the people that follow you?
I guess there is no real danger. I think it comes from my social experiences growing up and the chip that I have on my shoulder for this society, not wanting to get too close to the people who may or may not actually be cool.
I see.
They actually might like your music, but aren't good people.
You know, man,
unfortunately.
It reminds me of me and Reagan, you know, bus driver, we always talk about this because he gets that bad, I think just from being exposed and exposed to kind of like intellectual indie culture for a long time.
Yeah.
He's always got people that when he really starts to espouse his views on society and inequality and all of that, he gets like a lot of really like right wing kind of like responses. And it's like, to me, it's like, it's amazing that those people ever felt like they had space, you know what I mean? To understand or like his music and can consider it to be along their thinking, you know?
Definitely.
It's interesting.
It's amazing what will come from the internet,
right?
In your direction when you choose to voice your real, the realest depths of your heart. You know,
absolutely.
It's not always a good thing to do for any of us.
For sure.
Unfortunately. But I think we got along just fine having no idea what Rakim ate for breakfast.
Yeah,
you know, we got along just fine. And I didn't know DJ Shadow was a white guy from the Bay Area. I thought that he was the guys on his record cover.
Right.
And they were out of focus.
Right.
So I really thought he was brown, some kind of brown.
Right.
I had no freaking idea. I got along fine. I didn't have any clue about any of my favorite artists. I was totally clueless. I wrote them fan letters to get fan club merch back, you know? And like, that was good enough for me. I enjoyed the music, maybe more than I do now.
You know what else it made us do? It made us pore over the details of the liner notes a lot more closely. It made us pay attention to everything that they put out intentionally down to the smallest detail because there was no access. You know?
And they were giving us these liner notes in this detail for a reason, for the real heads and the real fans to
connect
unearth.
The dots and understand all the networking and who mixed this and where was it mastered and all of that stuff.
You can follow their trail and remake their record with them. That's what they're giving you.
Right.
They're giving you that, but they're not like giving you their personal lives and their opinions.
Exactly.
They're like, this is my project. This is one moment. Here it is.
Real.
This is how I felt in this moment, translated through my creativity. It should speak volumes more than a conversation could ever have, or an email, or a Facebook, or Instagram comment, you know, interacting with your fans online like that. Because you get caught off guard by people and end up just, it's not as, it's just a tricky, it's a minefield out here, man.
That's real.
And it doesn't have to be so serious. We could just take it with a grain of salt and like, who cares what they think and who cares what I think? Just sharing because you feel the need. But
now in our new, you know, at least in the paradigm we're in right now, we're just all constantly swimming in each other's thoughts because they're all very readily available. So it's a lot more difficult to ignore.
The LP's conspiracy theories used to be kept amongst his friends and now the whole world is listening and it's becoming major television news. Some of the subjects he's touching
culture.
On it does it's crazy bringing things into the forefront that used to be so taboo now are readily discussed, freely discussed, you know.
You kind of mentioned that there's a little bit of a disconnect in your on stage persona and how, you know, big and wild it is with who you are as a person. When you started off DJing, was there persona present? When, like, as soon as you started?
Yeah, basically, growing up in San Diego with Orko and
Orko,
Ganja Sufi.
Yes, yes.
And Odessa Kane and even Daddy Kev came in and out of the scene a little bit. That's where I met No Can Do. Mm-hmm. You know, we were 16, 17, 18 years old. So people were, they had a ferocious appetite and they were battling each other in the streets and they were having sidewalk ciphers and every step you took in San Diego area you had to be on guard for someone to step to you and battle you because that's the era I grew up in. And so it keeps you kind of hip-hop in the b-boy sense of the word. It keeps you kind of like in your like good posture, ready to somebody coming at you from behind, somebody coming at you from in front, maybe not with violence per se, but like somebody popping off.
But that same kind of kung fu readiness.
Exactly. Yeah. Kung fu readiness. I like that. But yeah, I mean, I just always had somebody trying to take my place since the beginning. They saw this little, you know, Middle Eastern Jew coming up in the ranks in the DJ world and in hip hop in the small community. And that was a threat to a lot of the homies that had been doing this. My parents didn't show me hip hop. You know, my brother and sister barely showed me hip hop.
Were they older?
Yeah. My sister had a Too Short tape. That's really what did it. But also MTV was just on the television, you know, but ever since I could remember, I felt like, okay, this might not have been the destiny my family foresaw for me. Yep. It might not have been the road that was shown to me by my society and my structures in my family, my school, all my neighborhood, all of that. I had to go outside of those structures to find what truly interested me in the world. Right. And I knew that wasn't exactly my family lineage or something. Like so many of our friends, their father isn't. Your family's in music, right?
No. My dad is a church pastor.
Oh, that's what it was. Yeah, okay, but he's a leader.
Yeah, he also sings too.
I knew it. Yeah. I mean, my father has been singing, playing piano and guitar for years, but only as a man who enjoys to express himself. But I had nothing, you know what I mean.
Right.
No footsteps to follow in. It was something that I chose on my own, and I always felt like I had to keep it extra close to my heart and I had to be extra disciplined and extra careful with this gift and with this path.
Right.
And every little step of the way, I've been strategizing even before I knew it.
Mm.
And I feel like that's part of my legacy and my history. And long story short, coming full circle now that actually some of this planet is noticing what I'm doing, that aggression that I step on the stage with, it's a culmination of that hip-hop kung fu readiness, as well as having a chip on my shoulder from growing up, getting punked, getting pushed around, and getting told that I wasn't in the right place.
Weren't down.
Exactly. And like that type of stuff, it stays with you. Maybe not everybody, because they break free of their childhood and they move on into adulthood. But I'm bringing everything with me, unfortunately. Mm. Not because I want to, but because it's part of my foundations. So that chip is very large, and it's always sitting there whispering negative, fear-ridden thoughts into my ear.
Wow.
And it's just something that we all have, but some of us have it magnified. And when you choose to put yourself on a platform where you claim to have something that the world might want, that in itself is a danger zone for your humanity.
What steps do you take to ease those fears that those things are whispering to you?
I meditate
and
I speak with my mother and my father, my girlfriend, my roommate, people who know me the most, people who are the closest people to me.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the people that I turn to in those moments where my fear logic voice is overpowering my childlike positive voice. Mm-hmm. You know, I always turn to my friends for that and my family for that, because they give me perspective, much needed perspective. They just cut through the fog and remind me of the bigger picture and of where I've been and where I'm going and all these things that I could do on my own, but it just feels contrived and my brain doesn't allow the two voices to coincide.
Right.
Unfortunately, it's either one or the other. And there's one always, they're both always there, but they're not always going to be
equal.
Audible.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You can tell from even just following your social media stuff that like family is very important to you, and considering this might not have been the path that they laid out to you, was there ever any resistance with them about you going forward with this path?
Yeah, my parents supported my love for entertainment and performing always, but they thought that it would be in a more controlled environment.
Sure.
And they don't understand that even in the world of acting, singing, dancing, theater, Hollywood, that world actually isn't as safe or as you know, it's just not any better than my crazy puzzle that I've used tape and glue and blue tack and all these different adhesives to put the puzzle together. It definitely wasn't like perfect fit. Oh, here's another piece. Perfect fit. It was like jamming pieces together and then taping them. But that's how it is in every artist's career. And, right. and I think my family, they just saw one straight line. And instead I went zigzagging all over the place. And I don't think they were... I appreciate their skepticism and their fear and their worry for me. Right. Because it's true. I did take a very zigzag road rather than that straight ahead path. Just in their mind, there's a formula to success for artists and stuff like that. And most people think like, okay, you start when you're a kid and you get all the way on your path. You know what I mean? Like right. Classes and
right training,
college and an sure. agent and the whole thing. So much in Hollywood, we see it every day. You know, everybody, they take this formula into their lives and fail.
Right.
Like millions of people take that formula that's supposed to be, they take the classes, they spend the money, they right. get the headshots, they do the whole thing. This business, it's like music, thank God, we don't need headshots.
Right.
But nowadays, we might. But right. when I started, the whole thing was I could wear a bag over my head and nobody would care if the music was dope. They'd be like, yes, yeah. I'm going to follow this guy. It's definitely different than the rest of the arts.
Absolutely. When you talk about, it's interesting you use the allegory of putting a puzzle together to describe your path, because I think it would be way oversimplifying to say that you're just a DJ, you know what I mean? So I'm wondering, like, okay, when you meet a stranger and you're trying to describe what you do, like, what do you tell them?
I tell them that I make psychedelic instrumental music, and I keep it vague like that,
okay.
and if they YouTube me, that they won't, that might not be what they find.
Right.
But if they dig a little deeper, maybe it will be. Like right now, it used to be my performances had the most YouTube views naturally because right. I don't have that much music out.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd come up on this video of me in China where I was screaming at these Chinese people about their cigarettes and how much I hated their cigarettes. And it was like a video. It got like 500,000 views. God only knows why. It was some sort of DJ YouTube.
Right.
And this was in 2009. And I was literally, I wasn't over here scratching and doing right. some skilled thing. I was like, goddamn cigarette smoking Chinese motherfuckers, you're making me sick.
Had you stopped the music to say it? Or
I was cutting it in and out. You know what I mean? But like, and that's the part of the video they put up, probably because they wanted this wild, like, TMZ moment
right.
of my set rather than so anyway now you'll find Nisim, my song that I made for my brother rest in peace, and that song is psychedelic instrumental Turkish music. I don't mention the world element when I describe it to people because that narrows it too right. much. That might be the first thing you see now when you look for me. Boom, Nisim. There it is. That's my explanation. If you find another video right next to it, my Boiler Room set might be a little different. Then you find live at Low End Theory Festival. This guy put up these amazing HD videos of my show there.
Mm.
And nobody's done that in a long time. Like putting up blocks where they got my whole set.
Mm-hmm.
15 minutes. Like crazy. Like perfect steady cam footage. So that's now in the mix again, where you could see a set that I actually am like, damn, I was going over 9,000. Wouldn't have noticed if there was a camera right in my face. Right. I was so in the zone. That might be what you find. So it really all depends. It's weird. That's just the choice that I made to describe my shit now.
Do you go back and watch videos of yourself performing?
I'll go back if things catch my eye on Twitter
okay.
and Facebook. an Instagram.
Sure.
But I don't search for myself online anymore, not on any right. in any way, right. shape, or form, except to see if the promoter's promoting my show.
Of course.
Coming up. Then I'll look it up. I'll type in GLK Denver, September 19th. What
see
do you
what's
find?
Happening.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Have they been doing their job?
Oh, sure.
That's something I'll look up. But everything else is just pure and utter cringeworthy pain most of the time.
I hear you. And I, you know, just even in my performance, which is, you know, a little bit more, I guess, straightforward in terms of a rap performance. There's a certain abandon I have to have to be present in that moment.
Exactly.
To where, you know, I usually don't watch my performances because I don't ever want to be in my head like that when I'm
nope.
on stage.
No.
Nope. You know, do you find it's a similar?
Of course. Thing? You have to give the people standing there.
Right. Exactly.
The show.
Exactly.
It might not translate to the video camera, and that feeling that you have might not ever translate, but you had it and they got it because
yeah.
they're the ones standing in the front begging you for it.
Right.
So those are the people you honor. And then you look at it later and you go, damn, I was on one. I'm not really feeling that
mm-hmm.
that move, or I'm not really feeling where I went with that song, or how I, maybe you were in a cheeky mood, you know what I mean? It's just
right.
one of those things. So
you just let that
after.
Spirit
yeah.
take hold in that moment.
Low End Theory does not stream anything.
Right.
We don't broadcast shit.
Black box, blacked out.
Yeah,
yeah.
And it's the room is blacked out.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? The only thing you got are visuals over us.
Right.
There's not even like a light on the DJ or the performer and then visuals over there. It's like the performer's in the visuals.
Exactly. It's like projected onto you.
Yeah, and then outside, there's literally one colored light. People try to take photographs without a real camera. You're just getting pitch
yeah.
black.
Yeah.
You can't even record the music because it's too loud. We're not recording it either. It's like, that's our escape.
For sure.
That's our church to like our laboratory. That's our sanctuary, you know, to get away and to be present in the moment. And
yeah.
Kev really, he had that vision to create like a safe, dark performance space that you can get lost in again. I love that because that's being lost now. People want everything broadcast and
right.
YouTubed and streamed.
Perfect. They want it just perfect.
And perfect too, yeah.
yeah. And Low End Theory being a place that's, you know, for all its storied history and how successful it's been, it's still a relatively small venue. There's no green room. You're there pretty much every week. Does it ever get to a point where you feel like maybe it makes you too accessible in LA? That people can kind of just know you're going to be there and they can find you and talk to you?
No, because the only people who have the balls to come to Low End Theory are actual fans.
Word.
So if they care enough to get in our club and they need to say some stuff to me, I'll give them that time.
Sure.
As long as they're not drunk falling on top of me,
right.
everybody gets a minute with me, no
nice.
Problem. Your typical industry idiots don't come to Low End.
That's true.
Women don't get hit on at Low End the way they get hit on in Hollywood.
Right.
Should I say girls? We don't have many women. No offense, ladies. But you're young as fuck. So, you know, I hear reports from tons of women. My own girlfriend is there every week with
mm-hmm.
me, and she rarely gets cheesed on.
Right.
It's more like, hey, you know, are you alone? No, I'm not.
But some kind of some sort of respectful approach.
Yeah,
right? Just
yeah.
Like,
hey, are you alone? You need a drink? You know, stuff like that. But it's not like that sleazeball vibe. We don't have that.
Right.
And it goes for the performers too. Like the same guy who wants to melt all over your chick will melt all over you, and you don't want that.
Right.
If I was like the resident at some Hollywood club, and that would terrify me.
Right.
I mean, knowing where those people could find me every week would be horrible.
Right.
But anybody who comes to Low End, you must have a brain.
Right.
You must have a heart. You must have a soul. And you're following it in this direction, and that's an honor for me, you know?
Right. I've, you know, and just doing a little research for the interview, you know, I read a couple bios and descriptions, and I heard people describe, you know, your movements on stage as like as dance moves. And that kind of weirded me out for some reason, because it didn't seem like that was the proper thing to call them. So how would you describe how you move on stage?
I mean, if you look at any videos of hip hop in the 80s, late 70s and 80s, if you look at any videos, every single person in the audience, even Soul Train, like, you don't get to be a part of a performance like that unless you're moving.
Right.
Everybody must participate. This is the era that I was raised in. Everybody must participate. If you're on the wall, you're getting clowned straight away. Like, you must participate. If you don't have moves, you gotta just be up in the front with your voice screaming and yelling and clapping, you know?
Adding to the energy.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, any video you see of a hip hop function, you'll see the way I move. It's nothing new. I'm moving to the beat with my hips and my ass and my feet connected to the ground, feeling grounded into the earth, and the bass and the drums move me the way any human being, or any child, I should say, would move. If you look at the way a kid dances, you look at the way, you know what I mean? Like, hip-hop, the essence of hip-hop dance is super natural, and it's super participatory, and I'm participating with the music.
Right.
And they should be too.
Right.
It just so happens that I come from a b-boy background, and that aggression that I perform with, it's real. It's in my body. I'm like, just talking about it now, I'm tensing up
because
I'm thinking about like what the music does to me. And if you don't let it take you away, you're not experiencing the music, you know? And it's like, how much can your brain think? Why are you here? Mm. Why are you in the middle of a crowd of sweating teens? Is it because this producer, you want to stare at him? I don't think so, you know? I really don't. Most people want to move.
Right.
They just are shy about somebody videotaping them and putting it on Instagram or something. It's like so stupid. It shouldn't be restricted. It should be open and free, especially at low end.
Of course.
I see some stupid ass dancing
absolutely
at low end, but I love it.
It's beautiful.
It's so real. You know, it's not a bunch of pretentious bullshit. It's like people are just caught up in the moment. That's what I want for you. That's what I want for me. Every time I get on stage, that's what I want. I want to get lost in the moment and not think about the moment your phone comes out. You're taking me a little away from that spiritual center, you know?
Because you're not really actually present there. You're thinking about a moment or trying to, you know, capture it for some other people. But you yourself, if you got your phone out, you're not in that moment sharing it with
everyone. You just stepped out of it, and it takes me out of mine. I mean, this shit is sensitive.
I hear you. What kind of gigs were you playing in LA at that time?
Under the Bridge downtown, Warehouse Party downtown, Loft Party downtown, all downtown, all pretty much illegal.
Yeah.
Like back alley parties thrown by the same promoter that I work with to this day.
Right.
One of the most badass savages that's my age.
Right.
That came on the scene and started taking over with his fervor and lust for life and events, and like just would risk it all and would die for his shit to throw a dope party and be that legendary promoter. That's like, he wanted to bring raw shit to the community, and he'd based his whole career off that, and it served him very well, you know? And he brought out so many amazing DJs and so many themed parties and so many cool, wacky ass things. And he played favorites with me. I don't know why, but I was this neutral zone DJ who he could have. He wasn't from San Diego anymore. He wasn't really from San Francisco. He definitely wasn't from LA. He was just a nomadic DJ that played nomadic music all across the board. So I was his opener, and I started playing every single show for him. I'd never argue about the price, never argue about travel, never argue about anything. I just wanted to be down, and
this
he knew
it. This is dues paying.
Exactly. And it was like getting my foot in the door in LA. He made it possible for me, as well as Jamie Strong, Jay Logic, Valida, and Koopma, and Dublab, and Andrew Lohero. Okay. They took a huge interest in me from the very beginning and gave me a shot when other people thought the San Diego cat, the whatever, brushing me off. You know what I mean? The, right. They all gave
the
me
old
shots.
San Diego treatment.
Yeah, so I just felt like, oh man, I fucking finally found some people who appreciate it. And growing up your whole life and having people tell you you're whack, and then you move somewhere that should be the place where everyone told you you were going to get chewed up and spit out. That's the place that people end up loving you. Mm. That's destiny, man. Mm-hmm. That's power. Nice. Between Art Don't Sleep events and art shows with randoms and Dub Lab tour here and there, things like that, you know, were keeping me afloat mm-hmm. with the record store job that I eventually got fired from again for the exact same reason. 11 months to the day I got hired. My first day of work was 666.
Wow.
June 6th, 06. And my last day of work was 11 months to the day.
Wow.
I didn't even make it a year at that store. And I got fired for harassing customers and being a total asshole. One customer asked me something so stupid, I rolled my eyes and I was just like, get out. And I got fired same day. I told a guy to get out and I got fired same day.
What'd you do for money after that? Just DJ more?
I begged Dub Lab to take me on this tour to Europe, and I met my agent.
Okay.
So Dub Lab, they had their wonder boy Kootma, but Kootma didn't have a green card, and I needed to go, and I was begging them, and then Kootma was like, yo, Willie is honestly the only motherfucker who I would choose in my place,
wow.
and I cannot go, so just say yes to this poor fuck. Look at him begging you. Just bring him.
Yeah.
He should be the one to go. I cannot go. And I know he was heartbroken.
Of course he was.
But Frosty was like, okay, I can't pay you anything.
Right.
Dub Lab has nothing for you except a plane ticket, a seat in the van, which may or may not be cramped.
That's tight, though. That's
and
dope.
A bed for you.
Wow.
Wherever we go. That's maybe some places you might be on the floor of our hotel rooms, but for the most part, we should be able to get you your own bed.
A place to sleep, transportation. That's incredible.
Yeah, and food, because yeah. a lot of those places we played in
they
Europe,
fed you guys.
They feed you yeah. at the club. They make food in the club, like right. Paradiso and AB in Brussels and these places. They cook amazing vegan meals right. for a lot of the artists that come through. It's awesome.
Yep.
We're very fortunate. But yeah, so Kootma gave me his blessing. Frosty gave me his blessing. I went on that Europe tour and I manufactured these CDs with this weird old man in the valley. And I sold them for 10 euros a piece at yeah. every show. After my set, nobody had heard of me, but I blew motherfuckers away. And I knew they were lining up for CDs. And yeah. everybody else was buying records, spending their money on food and weed and all this stuff. You're and I was like, stacking. I'm not getting paid nothing. So I'm stacking, being as frugal as I can, mooching. Yes, because I'm the youngest one also. I was the youngest kid besides Flying Lotus, who's a little bit younger than me. And he wasn't on the whole tour. He kind of just flew in and met us. Because at the okay. time, his album Unplugged Research 1983 had just dropped, so he was getting paid a little bit and he right. was doing pretty well for himself. So I met up with a guy named Cherry Stones, who I had DJed with. He was a British, he is a London based DJ, one of the most heavy record diggers ever. He knows so much about music. He introduced me to his homie at Cargo, and I got an email 6 months later, 5-6 months later, from this guy at Cargo. Hey, I met you with Gareth on the street in front of my club, Cargo. We have Flylo coming out, and we wanted to see if you wanted to open.
Wow.
This was Flying Lotus's first London show, besides this record store, in-store. Mr. Bongo's or something, you know? It was like a dope-ass store to right. do an in-store in, but it was just an in-store. Yeah. So this was Flylo's first show, and Marianne Hobbs, Giles Peterson, and Benji B were all there.
Wow.
And my agent subsequently now was there, and she picked both of us up mm-hmm. on the same day. She was like, I want to represent you guys. LA is the next thing that's going to hit in London. You guys are the shit. Like, if there's more of this, bring me the rest of your guys. Like, wow. we want to work with you guys. And so I started going to Europe, making a little money there. I started getting a little bit more love. Low End started doing a little bit better right. at the time. That's right around when we started Low End Theory. In 2006, you know what I mean? Yeah. So everything was starting to work out in LA. And even though I got fired from my day-to-day, I had Low End on Wednesdays. I had Art Don't Sleep parties on the weekends. Do Over started right. becoming kind of bigger.
Since it is, you don't face quite as much opposition as you used to.
That's true.
Are you able to consciously enjoy it as it's going along?
Yes.
Okay, that's good. That's wonderful.
I'm enjoying my journey thoroughly. Fantastic. It did, almost losing my life a couple times, help me get perspective on what it is we're doing here.
So tell me about the accident. I know that's one time when you almost lost your life. You mind talking about that?
No, not at all. I have a scooter. It's an electric scooter. There's only 40 of them on the planet. This weirdo from Sacramento made it. And I bought it through Burning Man friends. And it's basically a Burning Man legal vehicle.
Wow.
You're only allowed hybrid, approved hybrid vehicles or electric vehicles.
Right.
Don't need to be approved. You don't need to register them with the BlackRock DMV. You don't need any of that. So Burning Man is a new thing for me. I've always grown up around people who enjoyed it, but I never went myself. I went. I discovered the scooter. I fell in love with it. I paid a pretty penny for it, so I thought I should use it in my neighborhood. So I would drive it around and
like go in the streets.
Recreationally through Highland Park with it. I made a couple long-distance trips on it, but I don't recommend it. Anyway, I got really comfortable on it, and I got in a... I was in a bad place in between tours, very upset, very reckless, very, very tired. 4th of July weekend 2 years ago, being irresponsible on it. I crashed and I ruptured my spleen and I barely made it. I didn't need a blood transfusion. I didn't need any organ to be replaced. My spleen exploded. They got rid of it. It's gone now. I'm living my life a little bit more balanced and a little bit more slowly than I used to.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still taking a lot of shows. I'm still stressed with a lot of responsibilities. I'm still pushing myself, trying to finish this next album. It didn't change too much, but it did give me perspective enough to enjoy the ride a little bit more than I was. It is about the journey, not about the destination. And knowing that I could stack enough chips to lay low for a minute is a rewarding fact, and it should be utilized as a life raft at times, or you know, the pit stop for the Formula One racers that are just going around and around and around on this amazing track, and they're gonna come pull over for their pit stop, and their car, their vehicle, and them get some water, and they get some new tread.
And they get to slow down for
rest up for a moment to go back out and do it again with your best foot forward rather than like a weak shaking toe dipping going, ugh, you know? So that's what I needed. Simple as that.
What was your recovery time like?
I'm still kind of not the same, but 4 months into it, I did a big show.
Okay.
6 months into it, I went to Hawaii and did a do-over, but I also stayed on the North Shore for a few days just relaxing. And so I took that as a vacation time. And then the next summer, I had a bunch of shows booked, so I went back to Europe and I caned it, and then I came back. So, you know, it wasn't that much recovery time, but it was, you know, mentally, physically, spiritually, a huge change and a huge shift, and all to the good, though. All positive, man. I don't think I would have been able to keep going at the rate I was going, and I needed to stop, and I'm so glad that I stopped, and I'm so glad I didn't lose my life, you know? I still am here. I'm the same person I always was. I just have less of an appetite for destruction and more of an appetite for happiness and peace of mind.
When you were in that time of recovery, is that when you were inspired to develop the Gas Lamp Killer experience?
Yes. Yes, my friends told me, hey, Willie, you've produced a few records with multi-instrumentalists featured. You've gone in and done a 45 with 10 Dutch Afrobeat players who have never heard Black Sabbath or Zelda, and you showed them in one day what this music was and had them replay it. And like, dude, you conducted a band. You've made albums. You got all these dope players in LA and they're all waiting to work and you haven't utilized them live. And I said, because it's too much trouble, man. I don't know about backline and I don't know how to freaking, I don't know any of that. Like, I don't want to be that guy who's hiring help. I've never hired help, you know, but they're like, now's the time. You don't have to hire help. Everyone wants to help because it's a big deal what's happened to you. Let's utilize this moment where you have time to stop doing the GLK solo thing and do something more, stretch yourself out a little bit, try something new. That's how the Gaslamp Killer Experience was born. I called upon some of my favorite multi-instrumentalists and I put together a band and I sent everybody the music and we had a couple of rehearsals and we nailed it and I couldn't believe it and we did it. And then I listened to the record, I listened to the recording from that show 4 months after my accident. We did a big benefit show where the Gaslamp Killer Experience debuted and I listened to it a year later and said, damn, this is dope.
It's beautiful.
So I decided to put it out. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that I liked something that I had done live, because that's for a DJ set, I would never put it out.
Right.
Because it's never as good as it could be if I sat there on Pro Tools and surgically cut it to perfection. Right. You know, there was no way I would have let something that wasn't perfected out, you know? And this was the first time, and I'm so glad I did it, because it opened me up to that. What we were talking about with Kev before we started recording it opened me up to that willingness to free yourself from what you think it's supposed to sound like,
right,
and open yourself up to new dynamic range and new dimensions in your music that can only be brought by the right musicians, right, and the right engineers. Nice. And to take your shit to the next level, you know, that's priceless. And a lot of people just hold on to their art, like keep them like little babies in it. Don't want anything to change, you know? Like parents don't want their kids to grow up. They're just too perfect and beautiful. You don't want them to get older.
They
want to
lord over them and keep them as children forever and not let them grow.
Yeah, and this experience was like, hey, great. You tried something new and it worked. See? Right. Shouldn't be scared. Right. Should be more open to trying new things. And that's totally changed my next album. The whole process has changed. And it's taken a little bit longer than I wanted it to, but I was right in the middle of it when I crashed my scooter, and what I did wasn't what I wanted to do anymore.
Hmm.
So I had to go back and take some necessary steps to color in some of these black and white narrowed songs and try and add new life to them and try to grow from that experience and grow, have the album grow from that experience that I had personally as well.
So when do you think people might be able to expect the new work?
I'd like to say 2016. I mean, I'm trying to finish it this summer. I've been trying to finish it this summer. I had a April 1st deadline. I had a June 1st deadline. Now I have a November 7th deadline, which is my 33rd birthday.
Okay.
November 7th.
And I know you're a Scorpio.
Yeah.
I am as well.
Nice.
7 days later.
Cool.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah. Madlib, J-Rock,
so
Daedalus, Mir One.
Yeah.
So many incredible people around us are really cool to know that.
Mm-hmm.
Cherry Stones, crazy people.
I was thinking about rappers too, you know, Juice and Wordsworth and
ooh,
and Pharoah Monch.
Ooh.
Like it's so many.
Cool.
It's so many.
You know, I heard that Scorpios are plentiful because our birthdays are right after nine months from
Valentine's.
Yeah. And I was like, oh man, there's got to be something else to this. So many musicians that I respect, so many artists that I respect have similar birthday time. It can't just be Valentine's Day, damn it.
Up to the Gaslamp Killer for taking the time out and talking to us. Hope you guys enjoyed that conversation. I sure did. We did that at Cosmic Zoo, by the way. So he was referring to us having had a conversation with Daddy Kev right before we talked, because we were at his studio. Big up to Gaslamp Killer. Big up to Daddy Kev. Big up to scientists in general. Big up to them. It's announcement time, folks. Me and my good friend Serengeti have made a project and started a group together. We are known as Kavanaugh. We have a new album coming soon. I'm gonna let you hear a song from it right now, because I love you. Because I love you. I love the song too. Interesting thing about this project, aside from the fact that me and this guy went to college together, have known each other for a very long time, is that this is the very first project that I have produced in its entirety. This is the first song. This is the single. If you can call something that we would do a single, you would call this the single. The single, not the double. Ugh, speaking of which, I'm so upset. The Cubs lost, and I don't even like them like that, but I'm upset. Anyway, first single, Kavanaugh, Serengeti, and I. And the song is called Screenplay. Write in, let me know what you think. If you think something good. Yo, shit. Yeah. You're not taking food off my table. I owe 200 grand in back taxes. I just wanna see you on your mattress. Eat your food and watching your actions. Look at your cable, touching your navel. Take you out dancing after that bagel. Got you a gift in the trunk of my sable. But you're not taking food off my table. Heart of darkness, extra nothing. I don't know combos, I'm pressing buttons. Except what I get, I'm question nothing. Except for myself when I'm high with you. Listen to myself breathe through my nasal. Nice and clean, we smell the witch hazel. I ask why I rely so graceful. Leave the whip book on the coffee table. Cause you're not taking food from my table. I just spent 2 G's on these glasses. Wake up in the morning, I could see your cactus. Wish you good luck as you try to actress. Watching your cable from your mattress. Bring me a cup so I can tip on my ashes. Got you a gift in the trunk of my table. You're not taking food from my sable. Brand new questions, old dimensions. RC Pro Am, pole position. Donnie Simpson, Julie Brown. Celebrity skin tags move around. I'm invented, this island isn't. So find which mind designed this kitchen. Clear my sinus, hear my silence. Don't trust fingers near my eyelids. Had this one chick, but she would not listen. Went to the bank, all my money was missing. Supposed to pay my tax, but she went out dancing. Played me for the fool, I was still romancing. So you're not taking food from my table. I just wanna see you on your mattress. Bring me a cloth so I can wipe my glasses. Pop that trunk, I can give you them bagels. I might lose it, truly let go. Kick the train door and sue the metro. Buy new software and do electro. And start to feel weird cause I'm too successful. Buy my book though, buy my house. I clear out next week and fly right out. Book it now, my funds are unstable. Ain't no books hot under that table.